problem is that I grew up with Italian, so I tend to talk with my hands
that's,
too.
That's great. Actually.
Okay.
I have no problem with hand talking. My wife is Brazilian, and Brazilians do the same thing.
Yeah, they do. All the Latinas do that. Yeah, they just put everything into their speech.
and that's the way it should. There should be some body language.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think that we've heard already the circumstances about how you got to Alaska originally, and do you maybe you can remember when you first heard of, or maybe the first time that you met Bob Bartlett?
Well, you know, it was not on my first tour when I first came up, but it was shortly after that, that when I came back, I got very intimate with Bob. One of the trips I took, I was at Nome, the Lohman brothers were raising or applied for increase in Lattery Ridge rates, and I was sent up to represent the territory on that one. And on the same plane with me, Bob Bartlett was on the plane with me, and Roy Perotovich was on the plane with me. When we went into the hotel at Nome, Bob and I got into the hotel, but when Roy stepped up, the woman at the desk said, "We don't have your name here," and turned him away. She realized that he was a native. Well, Bob heard about this, and he stepped in. If I had heard about this, I was going to say, "Okay, you can count me as a native too. I have some racial traits that you might not like." But I was just furious, and so was Bob. But Bob took care of Roy. He put him up at the North Star Bakery upstairs. He said he has a good friend there, so Roy had a beautiful breakfast in the morning at the bakery. But Bob was that way. He just would step in when there was something like that came along and take over and take care of any native that was traveling with him.
That's great. Let's stop right there. Can you?
Okay,
yeah, that's, you know, that was a great story, and it's something that I haven't heard from another person, mm-hmm. and it's such an important thing in that period of time that
yes,
Bob,
it was.
That Bob was working,
mm-hmm.
not only in Alaska, but in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
because if you go through the headlines of the 60s, you know, sometimes we forget, but, you know, from 1960 to, racial issues were, you know, really what was driving a lot of politics in Washington, D.C.
Well, that, you know, I grew up in San Francisco, and at the time I grew up, there were very few blacks in San Francisco. They were all over in Oakland. They stayed in one place, and it was almost like that was a ghetto area. And all the theaters, blacks weren't allowed. They went up to the balcony. And as a kid, that was referred to as nigger heaven. That was San Francisco, which is a very liberal city normally. We came here, and it was the same thing here. The natives were allowed in the theater if they stayed upstairs in the balcony. And that was, I thought that thing was in the past, but it was really there, and they had signs. You probably heard about this when you go up north there. No natives or dogs allowed. That was one of the ones that really infuriated me. I saw those in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Nome. I didn't see any in Juneau, though. But,
on that particular swing through Nome, did you just go to Nome and back? Did you go to any other places together?
No, that was it. We just went there. But it's one that stuck in my mind because I thought, gee, that guy Bob is sure great that way when he found out. And I was the first one in, so I was already in my room. I didn't realize what was going on. I didn't realize it was that sort of a situation in Nome. And it was very true. It was pretty rough.
Mm-hmm.
But Bob was that way no matter where he went. He never met a stranger. He was always open to anybody. He listened to people a lot. And a lot of politicians don't do that.
So this would have been about...
Gee, I'm trying to think. 40,
Is that my radiator's going?
It's ding, 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 let's see.
That would have been about, it must have been 41 or 42?
Nope, it was about 45, 46 around in there.
Oh, really? Okay, yep. So he was already delicate.
Yes, he was, it was already, he was well established as delicate at,
yeah,
at that time.
So what a interest, I'm pretty interested, or found out more about the kind of public opinion about Ernest Greening on this project. Because the two of them together, you can't talk about Bob Bartlett without talking about Ernest Greening.
Right. Yeah.
And so many people were just dead set against Greening,
mm-hmm,
because who he was, where he was from, really. I it seems to me, you know, that he was, because he was, you know, from the East, and, you know, and he was a pretty progressive,
mm-hmm,
politically pretty progressive. And that just really turned off a lot of people. I'm wondering if you came across the same thing with, like, with Bob.
Very interesting, as Bob said to me, he said, sometimes I can't stand the man, but when the chips are down, we're both together. And Ernest did have an arrogance about him. He couldn't help himself. And Bob never did. And Bob said that it's frequently, he'd been working on some legislation that was about to be passed, and Ernest Greening would come to town, and because he was the governor of Alaska, he was invited down on the floor, and it looked like he was coming down to receive the benefits of the legislation he had worked on, and there were things like that Bob, irritated Bob, but they were always on the same side. They never, never contradicted each other, and that was very good. But Ernest was a prickly guy. You had to handle him with gloves. For example, when I was working for him, he sent me to the Brotherhood-Sisterhood meetings. And I wondered why he's sending me down there. Well, in the, toward the end of the session, they always had a shaming session where all the bureaucrats were lined up on the platform. And Bill Paul Sr. was the prosecuting attorney. And then he would lash into you and lay all sorts of things against you. And then the old men who were the ones that had Robert's Rules of Order by memory would sit there as the jury. And then they would pronounce you guilty and fine you, say, $25. But when I got up there, I had the same problem. And when the girl came up to get my $25, she wrote me a receipt which said, registration fee for the convention. She said, you work for the federal government, put that in with your travel things, and you'll get reimbursed. And of course, it worked. But Ernest didn't like to be humiliated that way. The rest of us sort of took it as a joke, which it was meant to be. But that irritated him. So I was his whipping boy for 2 years.
That's a pretty interesting story.
We're talking about Ernest, though. We should be talking about Bob.
No, it's good.
Yeah.
Can you stop the camera just for a second? Can you widen up a little bit for me, too? Your memories, actually, is fantastic, being able to come up with these anecdotes like this. Did you get a chance to socialize with Bob and Bidey together at all?
Oh, yes. Every time I went to Washington, D.C., they had me out for dinner. And Bidey was another person. I really loved her. The two of them were a wonderful couple. They were fun to be with together. They had a good sense of humor. They were very relaxed about things. They weren't edgy about any criticisms. And they were just lots of fun to be with.
Klaus and a couple other people have pointed out or said that she might have been actually even a little bit more comfortable in public situations than he was, or maybe even, you know, a little bit better at it. He didn't seem to like the limelight very much. Was that something that you saw in him or saw in them?
Well, he was not one to push himself up in front of things. Ernest Greening was the opposite. He would just be right up there. Ernest could deliver a beautiful speech on any subject you asked him to talk on. Bob couldn't do that sort of thing. He could converse with you. And, you know, just like give and take, he was good at whether it was questions and answers. And it was like he was having a, what Franklin Delano Roosevelt called a fireside chat about things. He didn't mind rambling on a little bit beyond the question, too, and share some ideas with people.
When Bob took over as delegate from Tony Diamond, he immediately picked up on statehood, on pushing statehood, and he introduced the statehood measure, I believe, every session.
Yes, he did.
And there were many times it got to the point where it got into committee, and he chaperoned sort of safaris of committee members to Alaska. I think in one situation, were you asked to give a presentation?
You know, I can't remember. I may have, because I became an authority in Alaska once I landed here. When I was coming up here, I tried to learn as much about Alaska. My first 1945 trip, I couldn't find anything really decent about in the way of a reference thing except a report done in 1938. And so I corrected that, and I compiled a handbook for myself, which I then duplicated, that could be used as a guide to interpreting Alaska.
Were you ever called to Washington to testify before committees?
Oh, yes.
Committee hearings?
Yes. Ernest Greening had me back there several times when Goldwater was on. I remember being cross-examined by him, which was quite an experience. But he listened to what I had to say, which I thought was quite good because I had something to say.
Did you get the impression from testifying in these committee hearings that the people that were in opposition were actually fundamentally in opposition, or was it another issue?
It's hard to say. The question was, because Ernest Greening, some of his strongest supporters in the territory were Republicans, like Bob Atwood, for example, until they fell out at some point in their career. And then some of the Democrats were his staunchest enemies, like Doc Walker from Ketchikan and people like that. So you had a two-party system, and it was pro or anti-Greening, it seemed to me.
Wait, did Bob get caught in between that?
No, Bob managed to step out of that. And the thing was very interesting because Bob tried not to travel with Ernest because he said, if you travel with him, you're going to be upstaged every step of the way. You're not going to get a chance to be out in front. So he avoided being together with Ernest on trips.
That solved a big mystery because it's almost impossible to find a photograph of the two of them together.
Yes, I'm sure it is. And as I say, as Bob said to me, he said, I cannot stand him sometimes, but he said, when the chips are down, we're right there together. And that's true. They're both good liberal Democrats, which I was too, so I still am. And I'm not, I hate the Democrats calling themselves progressives. I don't know what the hell progressive means, but liberal means something to me. And after all, Abraham Lincoln was a great liberal, so was Teddy Roosevelt. When the meat packing industry poisoned his soldiers so that they had more casualties from poisoned meat, well, he stepped in and he reorganized the meat packing industry. But he says, I'm for free enterprise, but it has to be regulated.
I looked over some of the things that, for instance, you know Bob Dahrendt?
Oh, yes.
Some of the things that he had, he didn't like Ernest Greening.
Oh, no, he didn't. Actually, Bob and I got on very well together.
Yeah, and I don't understand. Mm. Well, it just seemed to me that this was one of those cases he couldn't really articulate what it was about Ernest Greening that he didn't like, but he sure didn't like him.
Yeah.
And he also wrote things about Bob. There was sort of a steady drumbeat of press coming from, I guess, conservative side in Alaska, criticizing the things that were going on in Washington, which seems remarkable now.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
When you look back. And I don't know if you were in Juneau at the time, if you saw some of that. Was there a particular quarter? Was it coming from Anchorage, for instance, or was it just all over, just generally?
It was sort of generally. Anchorage at that time was a more liberal community. It seems sort of strange, but it didn't have the population it has now. the military was not the big dominant thing when I first came. It became big. And then when you had military, you generally had a lot of a shift to the southern United States. That's where most of the soldiers were coming from. And you had there a shift into what we call a redneck sense coming from there.
One spot that I'm a little sketchy on, your personal history at least, was were you still working in government through the Egan era?
Yes, I had to check my. So I came up here in 45. The war took care of that. I was with the Office of Press Administration. And then Ernest Greening had me stay on for 2 more years. I designed a revenue system for the territory, which was then repealed when we got the oil coming in. For some reason, people think oil keeps coming forever. But you have to prepare yourself for a wasting resource. You have to treat differently than one that's renewable. And they missed all those fine points. I think I'm getting away from what your question was, but I forgot what the question was.
Actually, I wanted to talk to you about this stuff, and it has nothing to do with Bob Bartlett either, but
no.
We'll talk about it afterwards.
Yeah.
Because you said some things about oil companies, having worked for Standard Oil, I guess,
yes.
Back in the 30s.
The 30s, yes.
Yeah, that were, I thought, were pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Bob, do you think, I don't know if you knew him this well at the point in time when he was working in D.C. as Senator Bob Bartlett. Did you stay in touch? Did you see him when he was
yes.
here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would he call you up and ask you things about economic?
Yes, he did. He did. He asked me about, particularly about, as you say, because of my background with Standard Oil Company. I don't apologize for that. I had to take a job. My dad wasn't working. That was during the Depression. And I had majored in mathematics during my high school career. And so I was just what they wanted. Standard Oil was set up with what they called an economics department, which didn't appear on the organization chart. It was like a central intelligence group. And there were 6 of us kids who had been tested for mathematical aptitude, and we were the computer. And then, so I got the inside how they operated. It was quite fascinating. They competed to get control of the raw material. When that was accomplished, they then sat down together and said, they determined what the prices would be, what the share would be, and it became I can't think of the word they used to use, but it was one of those terms that's not a monopoly, but it's a oligopoly or a duopoly or something crazy like that. And it was things that it doesn't look like they're doing this, but they are doing it. And there are things that I was doing that were probably illegal, like we'd exchange information. I have the very important things that we have the output and the distillate so we. But my job was to put these together, but use little symbols so that we wouldn't be caught with the names. My other job was to go around and collect all these things and destroy them.
So you're a shredder and computer.
Yeah, right. I did both those things. I learned an awful lot.
Bob's background, he didn't graduate from college. He didn't have a postgraduate degree or a legal degree. Gold mining.
Yes.
And then it's like he kind of, I don't know, it's hard to describe, because you don't see people getting into a life of politics this way anymore.
No.
The way that he did.
Mm-hmm.
But he had to depend, it seems to me, or it's to many people that have looked at his life, on other people's advice, because he comes up with some fairly innovative and clear thinking legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that he had a handle on that oil was going to happen for Alaska? Did he see that, and did he discuss that with you?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And of course, I knew about it. In fact, when I was 17 years old, I said to my boss, why don't we bring that oil down? He says, George, it's like saying there's oil on the moon. We don't know how to get it out of there, but we know it's there. We're going to see that it stays there until we're ready for it. But Bob knew this sort of thing, too. You know, you don't have to have a university degree to be an intelligent person. And sometimes it's a hindrance. maybe I told you the story already, because the one that when I was working, my boss was the head economist for the OPA on the Pacific Coast. And if I told you the story, stop me. But he said, George, I've hired some of the best PhDs on the coast. I can't get anything out of them. I'm sorry, I did tell you this story.
Yeah, well, it's okay. The only thing I caution you is when you're making answers to me, if you can say, when you talk about someone, if you say they can say their name, like Bob, or if you describe a place there, if you say Alaskans.
That's right. I keep forgetting that because... the people that don't know that you're sitting here.
They're not hearing my questions, right?
Pulling this stuff out of me.
Well, the somebody else I talked to said that Bob called them one time, and this would have been in the 60s, and asked them about Anwar, or what at the time was Anwar. It wasn't called Anwar then, about oil potential. And so, obviously, you know, he was a ferret, it seemed, for information. There was something cooking about Anwar, and even then, and he needed more information about oil, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, when statehood was being sold to Congress, economy was one of the big arguments against it. How is this broke little territory, you know, going to support itself? And you did a lot of work in that area,
yes,
and I'm just wondering if you can recall any kind of sharing of information or conversations with Bob about that, any things that you might have done together about that, at least contributed to the way things turned out.
This was, the territory didn't have anything like a rational revenue system, and that was when Ernest Green, he asked me to stay on. The first thing he says, I want you to design a rational revenue system for the territory. He'd gone to the University of Washington, and they gave him a 200-page-plus bill. And I looked at it, and I said, well, this just reflects the federal regulations and statutes and so on, so let's do this. Your income tax for Alaska will be X percentage of whatever income you earn within Alaska. So you didn't have to go back. You finish your federal tax. You keep all the books out there. Then you'd redo it with just the income being income earned within Alaska. And then the legislature said, we'll take, X percent, 10% of 1% or whatever. So it made it simple. And that passed. It was adopted by the territory. It carried over into statehood until we got the big oil thing. And then the idiots, the legislature said, we don't need taxes anymore. And then so this wiped out all those things.
Sure, what do we need taxes for?
Yeah. So they end up giving the people money just to be here.
That's right, yeah. Can you tilt down just a bit and reduce my header just a little bit?
Am I getting too loud?
No. I'm just adjusting the camera angle.
How's that?
That's good. We were talking, and when we were driving over a little bit, about Bill Egan and Bob Bartlett, this is related to, we're talking about, well, they don't make politicians like this anymore, or they don't seem to.
They don't fit into the system. Politics now are done by they have computers. I mean, consultant groups. They go to people who manipulate the data, and it's not the old-fashioned way where you could talk man to man and woman to woman nowadays about these things and reason about them. It's all done by consultants, and it's to me that just, it's not fun anymore.
Well, the amount of money that's in the, it's in the races. I heard some story about how much maybe he spent on his first race for delegate.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about not very much money, certainly. They weren't buying TV.
No, that's right. We didn't have the media was limited to good old-fashioned newspaper reporters scribbling things down and then having them put into the press. That's where Bob got started as a reporter. And then you had the radio news was pretty dim. We didn't have commentators the way we had next. And then we get these more elaborate systems. This whole presidential nomination is a nightmare. When I think of the millions of dollars being spent on this thing, and they're still just standing there together.
Right. Last person standing.
Yeah.
It's a showdown. Do you remember? I don't know how. Were you real involved in party politics statewide in that period? Were you?
I didn't get myself too much involved because. As a consultant, I'm supposed to be neutral. I'm supposed to be, what does the data tell me? Not what does my boss tell me he wants? It always drove me crazy. Some of these consultants, like Teller, had some on his projectariat. I looked at the economic analysis he had made. You start with, well, what answer do you want, boss? And then they back it into this thing. And it was so transparent what he was doing. As a scientist, manipulating data to come up with the answers he wanted to promote this big boom thing he was doing. That was another experience in my lifetime, which we'll talk about in some other time, not now. But we didn't. That went beyond. And I say that was manipulation of our politicians by Teller's group, the Firecracker Boys.
Back to the topic about the character of politicians and the character of politics in those days. Mm-hmm. Was Alaska was a smaller place to be.
Yes,
certain.
Yes.
Much smaller place.
Much smaller.
And do you think that was part of Bob's style? Was that small? People knowing lots and lots of people. That he was a product of that, really.
Yes, he was. It was like a big neighborhood, and I know when we Gene and I first came to Alaska, we had to go on the Canadian Pacific steamers, and it was like you met everybody from Alaska because they continued on the railroad. This is before. At the time, they were flying airplanes, but the military and defense had the priority, so it was difficult to get that. So the average person traveled by boat and by railroad. And so, you then get acquainted with people at Nome, the north, all the way down to Ketchikan. The same people would be on the same boat. And it was a wonderful way to get the feeling, all the gossip from the different parts of the state, the territory at the time. That is gone now. You fly in, you drop down, you don't know where the rest of the, what's going on in the rest of the state.
Well, and I don't know if, I keep hearing something.
There's a humming.
That there? Between the two of them, you should be able to get something that's usable. I don't know. Yeah, none of this stuff started before.
No.
Yeah. But I keep turning things down over here. On this tape?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're rolling.
Do you recall the whole Mike Gravel episode?
I remember Mike Gravel. Then I conveniently forgotten about him. I don't know much about him. But
about how he beat Ernest Greening?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Yes. Well, we'll stay away from
that. That was the introduction of the new style of campaigning too. That was one where we weren't used to that, and it was more like Madison Avenue sort of thing. And Mike Gravel fancied himself to be a glamour boy.
Well, he was.
I never did like him.
Go ahead and stop the camera. You mentioned before that when you, whenever you went to Washington, you you saw Bob and Bidey. Did you ever get a chance to go to his offices in the Congressional Office Building?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do you recall like the sort of the atmosphere there? All what the difference, was it a flurry of papers flying around and, and people chain smoking, or was it?
It was pretty calm. Yeah. It was nothing like that.
Okay.
And there was nothing exciting going on.
No. There was no shouting or intercoms blaring. Can you recall anything, any particular legislation that Bob might have worked on that you were able to consult with him about, or that you worked together towards?
Well, we consulted on the transportation, on steamship rates and things of this sort. I became quite an expert on that, and we talked about that. And there was nothing really stands out of my mind right now as a statehood, of course. I mean, that goes without saying. We both were very much, I said that with statehood, Alaska would have been in a much better position because it didn't have a revenue system that was worth looking at. And once I went back and made an estimate of what they would have gotten during the war, World War II, I thought that was, World War I is the one that end wars, and World War II is just a continuation. Now everybody has a war, but when I say war, I meant World War II. I forgot where I was going on this question now at this point.
You were talking about steamship rates.
Yeah, the steamship rates. Those are the sort of things that Bob discussed with me. And
do you recall, right after statehood, one of the first big pieces of legislation that the Alaska's new delegation worked on was the omnibus bill.
Yeah.
Right, and that transferred a lot of the existing federal bureaucracy to the state. Mm-hmm. It did things like change names of departments. It made certain that actually you couldn't use the word, at least in government business.